This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 27th, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Mexico's president-elect meets with President Obama in D.C. as advocates call for an end to deportations and comprehensive immigration reform. Thousands fill Cairo's Tahrir Square as President Morsi's decree of expanded power sparks criticism across Egypt.
There is a huge mix of people down in Tahrir Square. There are people protesting today who have never once gone down and protested in their life.
And as world leaders gather in Doha for climate change talks, we'll go to Montreal, where an indigenous band is fighting a pipeline planned for their territory, and to China, where efforts to curb greenhouse emissions with biogas are running into challenges. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Four more Tibetan activists have self-immolated in recent days, sparking fresh anti-China protests in and outside Tibet. In northeastern Tibet, advocates report that at least 20 students were hospitalized after security forces violently repressed a protest. The students were all from the Chabcha Sorig Lobling School, which is reportedly now locked down. In India, Tibetan exiles staged a demonstration in New Delhi, accusing China of pushing the Tibetans to the edge. Bismillah Gilani reports.
More than 100 Tibetan refugees marched in the capital today, demanding international intervention in Tibet. Holding Tibetan flags and portraits of some of those who have self-immolated, the protesters accused the international community of being insensitive to the plight of the Tibetan people. 52-year-old protester Lobsang Dargyal.
Tibetan people have no human rights, and when they make sacrifices to demand their rights, they are totally ignored. They are dying a dog's death. That's how China treats the self-immolating protesters, while the world thinks they are crazy. Well, so many people can't go crazy without a reason.
According to Tibetan rights groups, more than 80 Tibetans have self-immolated since last year in protest against Chinese rule. Dozens have done so in the last month alone, and four lived in exile in India. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Support for UN recognition of Palestine as a non-member state grew today, while a U.S.-Israeli effort to dilute the proposal failed. Rami Al-Maghari reports from Gaza.
French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said today that France will vote yes to a proposal that would grant Palestine non-member state status at the United Nations. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he has the full support of all Palestinian political factions and that he is confident he will win the UN's vote. Yesterday, Hamas reversed course on the matter, issuing a statement saying that party leader Khaled Mashal has told Abbas his movement backs the UN effort, but only if Palestine returns the right of return and does not lose any land from the sea to the river. That proposal is expected to easily pass the General Assembly. UN member states are planning to vote yes, and the Israeli Daily Haaretz reports today that a US-Israeli move to amend the proposal to place the International Criminal Court out of Palestinian reach has failed. The vote is scheduled for Thursday. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Palestinian prisoners' rights organization said today that thousands of prisoners are on a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with three long-term imprisoned hunger strikers. According to the Yahrar Center for Prisoners' Studies, Ayman Sharana was released as part of the prisoner swap deal in October 2011, but rearrested on the basis of secret evidence months later. He's fasted for 149 days. Samer al-Issawi was also released in the exchange and then rearrested. He has fasted for 118 days. And Odai Kelani is on day 36, after his administrative detention was renewed without charge or trial. Advocates say all three have been denied adequate medical attention. Army Private First Class Bradley Manning is in a military court today. Among other defense motions, Manning is asking for all charges to be dropped because the conditions of his pretrial confinement have been exceptionally harsh. A United Nations probe found that Manning was subjected to cruel, inhuman, and degrading conditions. Private Manning is accused of providing a trove of documents to WikiLeaks. He faces 22 charges, including aiding the enemy. Authorities in the Mexican border state of Chihuahua have unearthed the skeletal remains of at least 20 people in recent days. Shannon Young reports.
The remains were found in a series of shallow graves on the property of an abandoned ranch in the Juarez Valley, a rural area east of the border city of Ciudad Juarez. According to an official statement, all 20 remains encountered were of male victims of murders committed approximately 2 years ago. Murders dramatically increased in Chihuahua in 2008 in a wave of violent crime attributed to a turf war between the Juarez and Sinaloa cartels. The violence peaked in 2010, at a time when the city and adjacent rural valley were covered in checkpoints maintained by federal forces. During that time, a campaign of murders, abductions, and arson displaced a significant part of the Juarez Valley's population. Information leading to the location of the graves came from U.S. authorities, reportedly as the result of the capture of a former member of the Juarez cartel. Chihuahua state officials say forensics experts are working to determine the identities of the persons whose remains were found in the graves. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Mexico's president-elect is in Washington, D.C. today meeting with U.S. President Barack Obama and congressional leaders and discussing the economy and immigration. The visit of Enrique Peña Nieto comes as Democrats and Republicans in Congress are pushing for immigration reforms. The House of Representatives plans to vote this week on a bill to give more visas to high-skilled foreign workers, while some senators from border states are pushing a bill to give young, undocumented people a path to legal status. But many immigrant rights groups say neither measure is enough, and they plan to continue a campaign for civil disobedience, calling for comprehensive reform and an end to low-priority deportations. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Ellis Olstein has more.
The Republican-controlled House is scheduled to vote this week on the STEM Jobs Act. It's an immigration bill that would give 55,000 additional green cards a year to people with PhDs and master's degrees in science, technology, engineering, and math fields, but take away the same number of visas from the Diversity Visa Lottery Program, which gives green cards to people from countries with low rates of immigration to the U.S. Because of that offset, the House Hispanic, Asian Pacific American, and Black caucuses came out against the bill in September, and it failed to pass. Mohammed Abdullahi, a Florida-based organizer with the National Immigrant Youth Alliance, shares those lawmakers' concerns.
All that bill would do is just give visas for high-tech folks that isn't your average immigrant that's crossing the border to feed their family. So, I mean, we support it, but we want it to be more inclusive.
To help the bill pass this time around, its authors added a provision that would allow thousands more spouses and young children to join relatives with green cards in the U.S. while they wait for their own. Though those family members wouldn't be able to work until they actually got approved for residency. Even with that provision, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin and other Democrats say it doesn't have a strong chance of passing the Senate.
Here's the problem. We can pick off elements of immigration reform that are popular with business groups and others, but if we're going to have true immigration reform, we need to keep the package together, and that includes the DREAM Act. You know how I feel about that.
While Republicans in the House focus their immigration efforts on those in line for a U.S. visa, some Senate Republicans want to focus on those immigrants who are already here. Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and John Kyle of Arizona, along with John McCain and Marco Rubio, are calling on their colleagues to pass their ACHIEVE Act, which some are calling the Republican DREAM Act. The bill would provide a path to permanent legal status for immigrants under 28 years old who were brought to the country when they were younger than 14. Both Kyle and Hutchinson acknowledge the need for comprehensive immigration reform, but Hutchinson said it isn't politically realistic.
I think taking one step at a time is the right way to go, and I think you would also lessen the number of illegal immigrants that are here by taking a part at a time. This is not only the most timely necessary action. It's also the most humane. These young people are in a situation where they've known really only American life, and you say go home, and they say we are home.
Some immigrants' rights advocates, including Abdullahi, say they are encouraged by this change in tone from the Republican Party. But he told FSRN why many are not supporting this bill.
If you are convicted of more than one misdemeanor and you're ineligible, so we have a lot of folks that get one or two misdemeanors just driving without a license, just trying to survive, just trying to go to work. What's the point of passing something that's just symbolic if it doesn't actually help anyone in the community? And for us, really, things are centered around right now about stopping low-priority deportations and making sure families are safe while politicians play whatever games they want to play.
The senators introduced their legislation Tuesday, coinciding with an official visit from Mexico's president-elect, Enrique Peña Nieto. Peña Nieto discussed immigration, trade, energy, education, and other issues with President Obama and Vice President Biden at the White House and with congressional leaders from both parties on Capitol Hill. At a press conference with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi Tuesday afternoon, he said the U.S.-Mexico border should unite rather than divide the two nations. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
In Egypt, at least one protester died today after inhaling tear gas as thousands filled Cairo's Tahrir Square chanting and waving flags. By evening, the AP put the crowd at more than 200,000. The protester died after clashes with police, bringing the death toll after nearly a week of protests to at least three. Egypt's security forces have made hundreds of arrests. AP also says police heavily beat one of its photographers while he was covering the event. People from across the political spectrum filled the streets after President Mohamed Morsi issued a decree claiming broad political powers. Judges and journalists have called for a strike and people marched in other cities, including Alexandria. We're joined now by journalist Aya Batraoui in Cairo. Aya, President Morsi met with members of the judiciary Monday. It's reported that a presidential spokesperson modified some of the presidential decree. What's the latest on President Morsi's expanded powers?
Actually, some of the Western media has misreported that this actually happened, that there was modifications to the decree. Until now, there has not been a single modification to the decree, and there has not been any sort of limiting of the powers that were issued last week. What has happened is you have more than 100,000 people gathered in Cairo and tens of thousands outside of Cairo protesting this decree. He still, at the moment, has the same powers he gave himself last week, which is that he has executive powers, he has legislative powers in the absence of parliament, and he also now has given himself powers to not be appealed by any courts. Any decisions he make cannot be appealed. What he kind of said yesterday, or through his spokesman, is that these issues that he has given himself powers for pertain to sovereignty issues. But it's a very vaguely worded statement, and to the many who are opposed to this, this is not enough. This is not a modification, and this does not explain exactly what powers he has given himself.
So if this decree has not been modified, if it pretty much stands as it was released last week, what does that mean in practical terms? What can a Morsi presidency do?
He is able to write the law, pass the law, and oversee the law. So essentially, he has executive powers, legislative powers, and now he has powers that override the judiciary. So in the absence of a parliament, because parliament was dissolved by the Supreme Constitutional Court, which is very much seen as a body appointed by the former regime and packed with former regime loyalists, they canceled and they dissolved the lower house of parliament earlier this year, just before Morsi was elected as president. And when that body was dissolved, he essentially was faced with having that same constitutional court possibly dissolve the upper house of parliament and the current body writing the assembly. So the laws he gave himself essentially protect those two bodies that are still existing, the upper house of parliament and the constitutional assembly. And he gave himself the power to write other laws that expand much wider, such as to protect, quote-unquote, the revolution, and take any measures needed to do that. Many people see that as a possible introduction to kind of emergency laws that were under Mubarak. And it's a very vaguely worded statement. And also the protesters say the Brotherhood was not on the ground on January 25th, 2011, when this uprising broke out. They joined 3 days later on January 28th. So who are they to define what the revolution is and what January 25th is really about?
Aya Batraoui, reporter in Cairo. As we are talking, crowds are gathering and growing in Tahrir Square. I know you've been down there in recent days speaking with people. What does this mean for the opposition, the ones who are filling the streets to protest?
There is a huge mix of people down in Tahrir Square. There are people protesting today who have never once gone down and protested in their life. These are people who have sat on the sidelines and watched politics unfold, but have been very, very fearful of a brotherhood, quote-unquote, takeover of the state. And so there's first-timers out here today. There are the liberal and the seculars who have been at the forefront of the opposition but have failed to unite and have failed to put out a united front, whether it was in the presidential elections where they divided their votes up and couldn't put one of their candidates forth to the runoff. And, of course, there's also the old regime who is riding the wave of the revolution, saying that they are taking part in this to, quote-unquote, protect the revolution and to protect judiciary independence when clearly they are former regime officials who just want the brotherhood out. So there's a huge mix of people in the square, but the spirit overall is definitely one of unity, in the sense that everyone disagrees with having a president who holds all three powers, and they say that he could have protected the revolution by creating a law to retry Mubarak that was separate from the decrees he put out and retry these former regime officials. And they're saying that he could have also added members to the Constitutional Assembly rather than protect it the way it is. He had the right as the president to add members to make it more representative of the diversity that is in Egypt, to add Bedouin from Sinai, to add more liberals and seculars to the body so that there is consensus, rather than protect it as it is now and not allow any sort of appeals to how it was formed or who is members of it today.
That's journalist Aya Betraoui joining us from Cairo. Aya, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
World leaders are in Doha, Qatar for the latest round of climate change negotiations. Despite increasing scientific studies showing a rapidly warming planet and growing extreme weather events, nations are not expected to reach an agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. There is growing frustration among many participants, including Zambia's Noah Simba, a member of the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance. He said too much time and resources are being spent to delay taking action.
We are also worried further that the very survival that affects human beings is affecting our planet as well. We are particularly concerned the fact that the continuity of traditional economic interests seem to be taking interest or preeminence in the current negotiations, and is threatening the survival of humankind, especially those living in this part of the globe. Regrettably, even at this point in time, COP18, which marks 18 years of negotiating, has wasted us a lot of time, and we don't see any indications for changing that landscape at this point. And when undoubtedly the effects of climate change can no longer be ignored, I think in the last few months and years, we have seen the rising evidence of calamities occurring, not only in Africa, but even beyond.
Simba criticized the consultation process of the negotiations and said it lacked transparency and accountability. The only legally binding agreement to reduce CO2 emissions that currently exists is the Kyoto Protocol, the current phase of which expires at the end of the year. Environmentalists and leaders from poor nations want rich countries to sign a continuation of Kyoto with stronger commitments. But there's long been resistance from some of the world's largest emitters, including the United States. Martin Kaiser is with Greenpeace and Climate Action Network, or CAN.
CAN also criticizes announcements made by the US, Canada, Japan, Russia, and New Zealand not to sign on the Kyoto second commitment period. This is unacceptable. And we call on those countries to reconsider and at least to do a comparable effort on mitigating emissions. The EU, which is willing to sign on the Kyoto Protocol, is not prepared for this conference. Although they have already achieved its 20% reduction target, it is not willing to reduce emissions further.
Some activists in Doha say this decade is critical for countries to take definitive action before the globe faces runaway climate change and increasingly extreme weather events. As world leaders continue international climate change talks in Doha, protests against gas and oil pipelines took place in a number of cities today in solidarity with indigenous communities in Western Canada. In Montreal, protesters gathered outside the offices of the Royal Bank of Canada, one of the largest financiers of companies operating in the Alberta tar sands. Proposed pipeline routes, including Keystone XL in the U.S., would carry tar sands oil across North America. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff reports from Montreal.
No pipelines on stolen native lands! No pipelines on stolen native lands!
No pipelines
on stolen native lands!
In front of the Royal Bank of Canada in Montreal's downtown financial district, around 25 demonstrators held a picket in the freezing cold. They're demanding that the bank cut its ties with pipelines in British Columbia. Drew Oyajay attended the protests with the group Climate Justice Montreal.
The Royal Bank of Canada is the largest investor, I believe, in the Pacific Trails project, which is the natural gas pipeline, and one of the biggest, I think the second largest investor in the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which would follow the same route. So it's sort of the Pacific Trails Pipeline would be laying the groundwork for that pipeline to go through. Royal Bank is also one of the biggest investors in the tar sands themselves.
Since July 2010, the Wet'suwet'en Nation in northern British Columbia have organized to stop the Pacific Trails Pipeline, owned by Apache, a Canadian oil and gas company. The proposed route of the pipeline is nearly 290 miles and would carry natural gas from northeastern British Columbia to shipping ports bound for Asian markets, all the while cutting through Wet'suwet'en territory, which covers 13,000 square miles. The Wet'suwet'en set up a camp in the pipeline's path and have invited supporters to come join them or organize solidarity actions in their own cities and towns. Last week, when Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chief Togastai and supporters found surveyors on their land, they issued an eagle feather to them, the nation's symbol for trespassing. And on Sunday, another surveyor was intercepted on a neighboring territory. Indigenous people consider British Columbia to be unceded territory, meaning no First Nations in the province have signed official treaties with the Canadian government. Some band councils have signed agreements with Pacific Trails, but Chief Togastai claims such deals are controversial.
The company will say that they've got 15 out of 16 First Nations who approve of their project, and it's not true. What they have are bands, Indian bands, which are basically wards of the Crown, and the bands don't have any jurisdiction off of their Indian reservations. What they're attempting to avoid is the meaningful consultation that's needed to have with the hereditary people, and we intend to make them stop doing that because it's disrespectful to us. They're breaking their own laws. They're breaking our laws. And, we just don't tolerate that kind of behavior anywhere.
Members of the Unist'ot'en clan are currently in Trinidad and Tobago to show their solidarity with struggles against tar sands development there. A protest took place in Port of Spain Tuesday to support the Wet'suwet'en and to denounce all pipeline and tar sands extraction. Solidarity actions also took place in 10 other Canadian cities, as well as one in Chico, California. Some protesters said the campaigns won't end until the pipeline companies pull out for good from all unceded Indigenous territories. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
China has subsidized construction of tens of millions of biogas tanks in rural areas over the last decade. The tanks produce fuel for heating and cooking and reduce agricultural pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. But experts say it's unclear how many of them are actually in use across China. And as young Chinese migrate to cities, many biogas tanks are falling into disrepair. FSRN's Mike Ives has more from Yunnan Province, China.
Ah. 84-year-old Zhao Jinhuan gathers with neighbors as she demonstrates how to light her biogas cooking stove. The gas was produced in her backyard from fermented pig manure and travels to her kitchen through a slender metal pipe.
It's very convenient. We can cook whenever we want, and it's very clean.
Biogas has existed on a small scale in China for decades, but since 2003, the government has aggressively subsidized household biogas as a means of reducing greenhouse emissions and dependence on coal, firewood, and natural gas. A typical household biogas digester here costs the equivalent of about $500, and the government typically foots two-thirds of the bill. But biogas experts say a lack of official data makes it hard to know how many of China's estimated 40 million biogas tanks are actually in operation, and to what extent they have reduced pressure on fossil fuels. What's clear, they say, is that in rural China, some residents are abandoning biogas tanks as young people migrate to cities and leave their parents and grandparents in charge of maintaining them. In this rural corner of Yunnan province in southwest China, a repairman who maintains biogas tanks says only about 100 of 500 tanks in the three villages where he works are currently in use. The repairman, Zhuang Guangyue, says most of the unused tanks belong to households where the younger generations have migrated to cities to find work.
In the houses where people have gone to the cities, biogas tanks are no longer used for biogas. Instead, they are used for water storage. When you turn the biogas switch, only air comes out.
In addition to migration, some say biogas is falling out of use in China because of the increasing availability of cheap electricity. Joel Baumgartner is the operations manager for Initiative Développement, a French NGO that promotes biogas in southwest China.
Once you have a better income, very often you prefer to use more kind of convenient energies like electricity. I mean, if you just have to turn a switch to have electricity, that's great, even if it's twice or three times the price. But if you can afford it, you will use it.
Another challenge, says Baumgartner, is maintaining a biogas tank. It's a labor-intensive process in which owners must shovel lots of manure into storage tanks. Naturally, the task often falls to strong, healthy young people. Back in the rural Yunnan village, Zhao Jinhuan says trees cover nearby hillsides partly because biogas has reduced the need for firewood. But she also says many biogas tanks here lie unused because their owners have migrated to the provincial capital, Kunming, in search of employment.
If they no longer cook on their biogas stoves, they don't bother fixing them.
China says it's committed to promoting renewable energy, but that's proving difficult as the global economic slowdown hurts the profitability of its wind and solar power sectors. It remains unclear how biogas will figure in China's medium or long-term energy strategies. But Baumgartner, the Yunnan-based biogas expert, says the government should make a better effort to maintain the millions of biogas tanks it has already financed. Baumgartner says a typical biogas tank here must operate for 1 year before it offsets the carbon produced by the roughly 2 tons of cement required to make it. If a digester operates for less than a year, he adds, it indirectly contributes to global warming. Mike Ives, FSRN, Yunnan Province, China.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapshi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.